Back in the old days with our founding teacher, he was a monk for a number of years, and for whatever reason, he brought with him a kind of an approach to Sangha where we'd come in silence, we'd sit in silence, we'd take our break in silence, we'd leave in silence. You might go, you know, hey, but then. And he was a totally wonderful teacher. When Tim and Tuwari took over, they both said, we want people to be able to talk to each other. So thank you for doing that. I don't know how many of you were here last week when Carrie was here. Can I just see? So a bunch of you heard her share a personal story about, she's always been a pretty serious person. People are always telling her to lighten up. And she told this story about being in California one day and a stranger was driving in this car and rolled down his windows. I think it was a man, and yelled out something like, you know, why are you so sad? Or what's the matter? And I thought about that, and I think that if a stranger did that to me as I was walking down the street, they might yell out, what are you smiling about? So, but appearances can be deceiving. It's true that I am really fortunate that joy comes very easily to me. But there's also a part of my personality and conditioning that contains a kind of distorted picture of joy. We call her Susie Sunshine. So Susie Sunshine has some positive qualities, you know, because the way she shows up is that pretty much she can always find kind of a more positive way to frame whatever is happening. Good friends of mine have told me that Susie Sunshine is pretty obnoxious and I could just keep my mouth shut. My brother and I have talked about, he has a little bit of a Bobby Sunshine nature to him too. And I think part of it is that we came from a family with a very sad mother. Our dad died when we were very little. And I think both of us as little, you know, as children, you look around and you make decisions about the world and you figure out what you're going to do. And I think both of us said, well, we see what she's doing and that's not such a good idea. So we'll try something else. Another positive quality of Susie Sunshine is that I laugh a lot. I grew up in a family that even though I had a very sad mother, we laughed all the time. Often it was laughing at things that weren't very funny. I come from an Eastern European immigrant Jewish family. It's really pretty common for families like mine to try to put a pretty much of a some humor on our lives because sometimes we could deflect how hard things had been. But another way of describing Susie Sunshine is that she was in a lot of denial about dukkha, that wonderful Pali word that describes the unsatisfactoriness of life because nothing is solid and dependable and certain. And so instead of doing what we've been taught to do in our practice, which is to really be with dukkha, know it and experience it and understand it, Susie Sunshine liked to jump over it. I did a lot of jumping into fixing. You know, I knew why I had been doing it. I understood, you know, we all come from families with certain conditioning. And as a young girl, I tried to cheer up my mother. And I thought if I just brought a little more sunshine into the room, then everything would be good. And you can imagine I was not very successful at that. And over the years with my practice, I've really gotten to take a pretty nice, hard, honest look at Susie Sunshine. You know, Thich Nhat Hanh tells us that without suffering, you cannot grow. Without suffering, you cannot get the peace and joy you deserve. And he says, he admonishes us, don't run away from your suffering. So through my practice, I stopped jumping over. I still have to watch Susie Sunshine. She tries to sneak in at different times. But I saw that I could really be with dukkha. I didn't have to run away from it. And I've seen the role that I play in creating a lot of my own suffering, that second arrow that we talk about so much. I still have to be pretty careful, but I'm having a better relationship with that first noble truth that we spent all last year on. And dukkha is the very beginning of this whole pathway that we're on this year of transcendental dependent arising. It's the condition out of which faith arises. Faith, and we used a whole bunch of other words last month of trust and confidence, but it's out of that that this joy arises. So we've had two talks on Monday night. I'm the third on joy. We've had three talks on Sunday mornings, and I don't know, I don't go to the Thursday nights, but I think they're doing the same thing. And I've learned so much from the different voices and from the Sangha, all of you, as you raise questions and share your experience. Last week, Carrie said that the cascade of joy is always present in some form. And I took that to mean that joy is always accessible. And yet we don't always experience life that way. So tonight I want to talk about two things. First, what are some of my thoughts about what stands in the way of our finding joy, that always accessible joy? And then secondly, some specific practices that we can do that might help us find joy more easily in our practice and our lives. So I agree with Carrie that joy is always accessible, but for many of us in many moments, it just doesn't seem that way. And one of the things I think is that stands in our way is how we define joy. What it's supposed to feel like, when, where does it come from? You know, our culture tells us, you know, it should be the next adventure, the next thing you're going to do, the high that we get when we indulge our sense pleasures. And yet we are all practitioners, and we know that that's not the kind of joy we're talking about. We're talking about a joy that's not dependent on external circumstances. It's a joy that comes from within. So in these views that we have about joy, you know, I think sometimes we feel like if I'm going to feel joyful, it should fill up all of the, take up all the oxygen in the room. That's what should be present, and only joy. But that's not my experience. I've shared this story with the Sunday Sangha, but it's a good story. It was a good experience for me of understanding how joy can appear alongside sadness and grief and fear. So 8 years ago, my partner of 35 years went off for a run. He had a rip in his aorta and died. And my world turned upside down, and it was pretty horrible. It was in September. And sometime in like early November, you know, sometimes in Seattle, we get these really nice days. It's dry, it's not beautiful sunny, but it just feels good. And I was all dressed warmly enough, and I live on Lake Union, and so I just walked down the path towards the canal, the ship canal, and I walked for a while, and I found a place to sit, and there were cormorants flying around, and the, you know, other birds in the water, and there was The water had that really lovely color that sometimes the lake gets. And the thought arose in my mind, what's missing in this moment? And the answer was immediate, and the answer was nothing. So here I was, filled with grief, sadness, fear. What in the hell am I going to do? My partner just died. He was partner in life and business and everything. And yet there was this sense of connection with the water and the birds, and I was feeling good and I was warm, and really there was nothing missing. So I think sometimes our attitude or our belief about joy can get in the way. Another belief that we sometimes have, I think, is that if we're feeling joyful, we should feel all like warm and fuzzy and giggly, and everything is, you know, big smile on our face and all that. Well, 2 weeks ago on a Sunday afternoon, 9 of us gathered on Zoom to have a discussion on anatta, one of the 3 characteristics of life, the teaching around self and not self. We shared among the 9 of us some really heavy issues, some personal struggles we're going through, a lot of tangles of emotions and patterns, and all of us felt so much joy during these couple hours. There was honesty, there was willingness to really listen to each other, to be vulnerable. There was joy in that commitment to just be wholeheartedly present and offer each other support and perspectives. So sometimes what we think joy is might be an obstacle. I'm sure you all have your own views on this, and I look forward to hearing some of them. Sometimes it can also be hard to recognize the joy that's already there. Last week, Carrie was really encouraging us to look at the joy that's already present in our lives and our practice. And sometimes it shows up in kind of weird ways. Here's another story that I think I may have shared with the Sunday Sangha. So I own a bunch of property on Lake Union. I have 7 small business tenants. I live there, but they all just have workshops. But I do have 2 men who live in a small apartment behind me. And I did some changing in the language of their lease, and they, in response, said, well, if we're going to be seen more like housemates, we'd like a better storage unit in this right outside of our apartment. And fortunately, my response was pretty neutral in my face when they said that to me. But once I was by myself, I was just filled with all this resistance to their request. It was like, wait a second. This is my place and my house, and I don't want to have to switch storage units so that I have to be way over there so that you can be over here. I was just filled with this resistance, and I labeled it what it was, which was stinginess. It was like, I want what I want. You know how little kids go, but it's mine, you know? And it was like I was back as an 8-year-old. It's mine, and I want it. And then the practice showed up, and I thought, and I knew that I don't want to be a stingy person. I'd much rather be a generous person. And once I kind of honored the desire to keep what I had and to not change, and then I looked at, well, what would it really feel like if I made this generous decision? It was pretty easy. And there was that kind of joy that just, oh, I can make a wholesome decision that feels really good in my mind, heart, and body. We have beliefs about joy. Yesterday at the Sunday Sangha, Candace was our teacher, and she said sometimes people think that joy is, oh, it's just this shallow, frivolous thing that, you know, it's nothing serious. It's not like serious Buddhism that we should be talking about suffering and selfing and all that. You know, and sometimes we believe that we need to do something to earn it or to deserve it. So I just ask you to, as you're spending time with this month of joy, and as things go on, ask yourself, you know, what are your beliefs? What are your attitudes about that? So then I want to spend some time talking about practices. I think that joy is accessible in the simplest things, the simplest parts of our lives, and also the complex. So remember when you first started sitting, and the first thing most of us had to do, we had to find a place in our, wherever we lived, that where we could sit. We had to decide was going to be a cushion or a chair, and if it was a cushion, do I have one? We had to get it and then have things under our knees, and then we had to figure out a time, because if we live with other people, it's a time where they're not making noise or I'm not going to inconvenience them. And then for most of us, we figured that out. You know, we have our place, we have our time, and we get to go there, and there's, I don't know about you, but even when my sit is a little restless or my mind's all chattery and stuff, there's something so right about taking some time for quiet. Just that, oh, I have my place, I have my time, I'm going to do this, whatever the amount of time that I'm giving over to it, and I can just appreciate that gift that I said when we were meditating together. It's a gift that we give ourselves. And there's a kind of simple joy for me that comes just from knowing I'm giving this to myself and there's this opportunity for quiet. Then there's some of the simple instructions of our meditation. You know, we're asked to just sit and watch as the moment arises, what shows up, what happens in the body, in the mind. You know, I don't know if everybody's had this experience, but I'll give an example. So you're sitting in meditation. This is really happens when you have like a longer period, say you're on retreat for a week or a weekend, and there's a pain somewhere in your body. And you start out, you're doing good. You're just, you know, you notice the pain and it's throbbing, or maybe there's a stabbing, maybe there's a lot of heat. But the next thing you know, the mind is just scared. What does this mean? Oh, and maybe it could mean that, or maybe it could mean the other thing. I better do something about it. The next thing you know, in your mind, you're on a gurney in the emergency room. And then you maybe smile and you go, oh, wow, did I go on a trip? And you take a breath and you come back and you go, oh, right, let me check out this pain in the body. Maybe the sensation's the same, maybe it has changed. But you watched it and there's that simple joy of knowing you can come back, you can start again, you can watch your mind, you can watch as it goes on these trips and where it can create all kinds of stories, and then you can come back to the practice. There's some more complicated ways of finding joy in the practice. Not hard, but complicated. The three characteristics of life. There can be joy in knowing the dukkha. You know, Carrie had said that it's not dukkha that leads to faith, it's the knowing of the dukkha. It's the knowing that things are changing, and you watch your mind as it goes, I don't like this. And then you go, okay, I don't like it. What, you know, you notice the pushing away, or I really like this. And you notice the grabbing. So there's that joy in just knowing the dukkha that arises in the body and the mind. There's the joy in knowing impermanence, anicca. We've all experienced that. Sometimes in our sits, we can really follow the changes in the sensations in our bodies. Sometimes if sound is your anchor, you can really watch as the traffic sounds come and go. Or if you're sitting with other people or in your house as you watch the voices arise and then leave. Maybe somebody's phone starts ringing and then it goes. And you watch it and you watch any kind of thought or clinging that arises with it. Oh, I wish they would turn off that music. Oh, right, there's music in this moment. And just that, the joy of knowing that you can know anicca, you can know impermanence. We can have joy in knowing anatta and selfing. So say you're at a social event and you don't really know anybody. So then you end up sitting next to somebody and you find yourself kind of on automatic pilot, telling all those stories about yourself that just show you to be just this fabulous person. You know, and at one point, even while the voice is going and the stories are being told, you realize, oh, I'm doing that. I'm feeling a little insecure. I really want this person to like me. I'm feeling a little needy. It's that self is really big. It's loud right now. And maybe you just end that story, follow up with the person, ask them some things about themselves. And the next time you get an opportunity to speak, maybe you're coming from a little less needy, me, me, me place. Maybe you come back to the conversation with, oh, I'm getting to know this person. I'm letting them know me. And how nice is that? I've shared often that a big part of my practice is reciting the five recollections. For those of you who don't know them, they are that I am of the nature to age, I'm not exempt from the truth of aging, I'm of the nature to get sick, I'm not exempt from the truth of illness, I am of the nature to die, I'm not exempt from the truth of death, I'm of the nature, everything and everyone I hold dear is of the nature to change, I will become separate from all I hold dear, I am the heir to my karma, abide in my karma, relate to my karma, everything I think, say, and do, of that I will be the heir. And it might sound counterintuitive that talking about aging, illness, death, and loss would generate joy. But for me, what it does is it grounds me in the nature of being alive. It just grounds me. I'm not in la-la land. I'm not denying whatever is showing up. It instantly generates generosity, I mean not generosity, gratitude that I'm alive and I'm healthy and I've got people and things that I do love and hold dear. It keeps me in the truth of just this life, this moment, just now. Gratitude is a lovely practice for generating joy. So I had us in the meditation, you know, being grateful for our feet and our legs and our organs. I learned to be grateful for my body in a pretty painful way. I had an older sister who was born with spina bifida, which affect her neurologically and through her urinary system and her circulatory system, and it also distorted the way her limbs grew. And I adored my sister Nancy. And I was in my early 20s, and I don't know if men go through this, but we women often make very disparaging comments about our bodies. I don't know if anybody would agree with that. Okay, I saw a couple nodding heads. So I had bought this new dress, and I can even picture it to this day, the colors of it. It was this really cute dress. I was trying it on for my mother and sister. And there was a full-length mirror in the room, and I looked at myself and I said something disparaging about my legs. And then I looked over at my sister, and the expression on her face, it was just like this stab of embarrassment and shame and, oh my goodness, what did I just say? Here I was, this young person with a totally able-bodied body, disparaging these legs that were shaped right. Now, maybe I didn't like them, but they were shaped right and they were healthy. And while that started with confusion and pain and embarrassment, it was one of those dukkha lessons that you learn from. And I can't say that I've never said another disparaging thing about my body, but boy, am I grateful for the health of this body. Another thing that, in addition to the practices that I've mentioned, many of us have sat with Philip Moffat when he's done his December weekend retreat. I've also been able to sit with him for weeks on longer retreats. And Philip has developed these metta phrases, these kindness phrases that he developed years ago when he was doing some work in the prisons. And the last phrase of his metta phrases goes like this: may you know love, joy, wonder, and wisdom in this life just as it is. And as I was thinking about joy, and I often use Philip's phrases in my practice, and I thought, I don't think it was accidental that he put love before joy, because I think that opening ourselves to what we mean by love, how we experience it in our lives, is a step right towards joy. I mean, what happens inside of us when we're thinking about someone or something that we love? And I'll put it more on a person, because when we're thinking about a person that we feel love towards, you know, most of the judgments go out of the window, because we know them, we understand them, and we can accept their foibles. And I think that that care, that love, that openness is a direct doorway towards joy. Some of us have signed up for years for these daily teachings that come from this Burmese teacher whose name is Ute Janiya. And he, a few weeks ago, wrote this piece that said, whatever you are experiencing in this moment is the right experience. There's no need to be happy or unhappy with whatever is happening. There's no need to like or dislike it. This is the right attitude for meditation. And he says, don't try to create anything. But I was thinking about that with, you know, we talk about joy as uplift, as gladness, as resting one's heart upon. Are we trying to create uplift or create this gladdened heart? And if we're not trying to make it happen, then how does it happen? And perhaps, again, it's one of these simple pieces of our practice, when we can simply be with whatever is actually here and not argue with it, I think uplift occurs. When we can be okay with whatever is happening, and I don't mean like okay in big giant letters, maybe little teeny okay. Yeah, I don't like this. This is terrible. It feels awful. But it's already here. Can I just be with this? There's a kind of easing that happens when we're not trying to create anything. We're just kind of getting out of our way. I think Carrie used some of that phrasing last time. And I think it's important to remember the last link of this transcendental dependent arising is freedom. that we're moving towards freedom. And in a way, moving from the knowing of dukkha, building a sense of trust and confidence in our practice, and in the natural, just the natural world and the way the world unfolds, and then moving to joy, and next month we be dealing with rapture. Isn't that a lovely concept and offering that we're going from dukkha? We're not going to get stuck in the muck of it. We're doing that noble search, and we're rising up and finding joy, and that's what's leading us towards freedom. I don't know about you, but it sounds really good to me. I have a friend, Dharma friend. I've known her for a really long time. And she recently shared this phrase with me of instant karma. She said that she went to a store and she just responded to this clerk in the snarkiest way that she could. She was just grumpy and snarky, and she said she could feel the instant karma. She thought, oh, good grief, that I don't even know that person. Why did I even do that? And she immediately set an intention for how she was going to treat the next person. I think there's these little moments and sometimes big moments that we can celebrate when we see through the delusions and see through the unskillful, and we make a choice for wholesomeness. We can celebrate those moments. We can celebrate when we've cultivated a mind that's quiet and an attitude that is inclined towards wholesomeness. When we practice patience and gratitude and we set the intention for clear seeing. When we understand the Buddhist instruction around ehipassako, which means see for yourself, that we're not just taking in whatever anybody says. We're really practicing so we can go, oh, I actually understand impermanence. Oh, I'm seeing when there's just me, 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 me in this moment and nothing else. And it's all about me. When you can actually ehipassako, when you can see for yourself, we create opportunities for joy to arise. One of the four Brahma Viharas, they're the divine abodes of loving kindness, compassion, mudita, and equanimity. And mudita is that amazing thing that happens when you can feel joy because somebody else is feeling joy. So I'd like to close with this poem by Billy Collins. He really speaks to this simplicity of joy. It's called Ode to Joy. Friedrich Schiller called joy the spark of divinity, but she, referring to joy, visits me on a regular basis, and it doesn't take much for her to appear. The salt next to the pepper by the stove, the garbage man ascending his station on the back of the moving garbage truck, or I'm just eating a banana in the car and listening to Buddy Guy. In other words, she seems down to earth, like a girl getting off a bus with a suitcase and no one's there to meet her. It's a little after 4 in the afternoon, one of the first warm days of spring. She sits on her suitcase to wait and slides on her sunglasses. How do I know she's listening to the birds? So joy is found in the simple, like Billy Collins offers, and in the complex. It's found everywhere. It's found inside of each of us. I found this phrase somewhere. It's kind of like a fortune cookie phrase, but it's so right. The door to happiness opens from the inside. And even though it's kind of trite, I think it's true. So I wish you all well on your exploration of finding those doors to joy. Thank you for listening. And we have time to hear from people how you're doing with this transcendental dependent arising. How you doing with joy? Is it always accessible? Is it hard to find? Where do you find it? How does it feel? What you doing with it? I welcome anyone online and in the room to share. And Cheryl will be our trusty runner with a microphone. And we do need to use the microphone so that the folks online can hear. So I know sometimes it's a little scary to share. I so encourage you to try it because, as I said, I've been part of Seattle Insight a long time. Every time someone speaks, there's at least a few people in the room who goes, oh, I'm so glad because I was wanting to say that, or I wanted to hear what they were going to say in response. So you're giving a gift to the Sangha when you share your thoughts, your questions, your reflections. So please, down here in the front. And if you would, say your name, because it's hard to get to know everybody, but it makes it easier. Thank you.
Thank you so much. My name's Julia.
Hi,
thank you very much for that beautiful Sangha. I was really appreciating the Susie Sunshine portion of your talk. I've had a similar personality alter ego that's followed me most of my life. And the last part that you had about the doors of happiness opening inward, I think I've been feeling that difference in my life with my practice lately. And I think that the feeling of Susie Sunshine feels like it's a performance for others. And I think that that inner happiness, because it is for ourselves, it comes across to others as more earnest because it's not intended for them, but the positive consequences are richer. So wow. Thank you. That really helped me understand that better.
Wow, thank you for clarifying and expanding that about the performance and for ourselves and for others. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know about, I think a lot of us grew up in ways where we needed to perform and get whatever we were looking for, whatever that might be. Thank you, Julia.
I did see somebody online put their hand up, so I don't want to jump over.
Oh, Nina. So maybe we'll go back and forth. Nina, please. I think you can. Nina's joining us from Puerto Rico. Hi, Nina.
Hi, Sus. Thank you so much. I've been listening to different talks on this transcendental dependent arising. And I must say, this is one of the loveliest, most joyful talks that I have heard. Thank you so much. And I relate to it so clearly how it felt, your talk about the acknowledgement of the dukkha, and that I have been feeling and just been discovering that during this time. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're so beautiful. Welcome. Nina is one of the six of us who teach on Sunday mornings. We take turns and thank you. Please go ahead.
Hello, my name is Andy. I am just speaking my thoughts. I don't have an actual defined statement, but joy has been a very ambiguous term for me, I think, my whole life, and understanding, like, accepting joy, especially in a lot of these moments of dukkha. And it's fascinating to be at this state of my process where I am seeing myself want to be in denial about some of these moments of joy versus accepting it and accepting that both can exist at the same time. I think the practice of that in the moment, I'm struggling with like understanding, but it's a beautiful thing to see in hindsight and understand that I'm struggling more with, or not actually more, I am struggling with the concept of accepting joy versus solely just accepting like the suffering and everything through that. So yeah.
Well, beautiful. And good for you. And don't we all learn so much in hindsight? And, you know, over time, sometimes the number of days gets smaller as we go, oh, that just happened. And, oh, I get that. And that's part of the, you know, the deepening of the practice, and it's the building of the faith in the practice, because we start seeing things. And Philip Moffat uses this phrase, the Dharma does you after a while. And it's, I don't know, I think in Christianity there's a sense of grace, you know, which is maybe similar, that it's not like you're doing it. You didn't sit down and with your journal and trying to figure it all out, but this thought comes and goes, oh, that was a moment of joy and I kind of discounted it. And maybe next time I can just kind of go, ooh, that felt good, you know? Yeah, we have these relationships with faith, with joy, with dukkha, with freedom. What do we think freedom is? You know, and exploring those relationships. Thank you for sharing that. Anyone else online want to share anything? Sometimes it's just like pausing. I'm going to just say this, and then and there's an opportunity to go from little mind, little thinking, and to go, this is what this means, to just kind of going, oh, I have two children, one I birthed and one I inherited. The one I inherited is my sister's daughter. And they're two fabulous human beings. And the one I inherited was visiting this weekend, and the three of us got together. We had a really good time. And then we went out for dinner, the three of us plus my daughter-in-law. And, you know, I'm 25 years older than they are. And during the dinner conversation, I was feeling so left out. I don't have these international travels, and I don't do this and that and the other. And I could just feel, feeling so left out. And what could I say to get back in the conversation? And I did say something. It was really inappropriate. And later on, I thought, wow, isn't it nice that the cousins really like each other? And then I just kind of relaxed that I'm left out and just said, the cousins really like each other. That's really good. So sometimes just going from, oh, I'm left out, oh, you know, to just broadening, you know, opening up stuff. So please share.
Yeah. Hi, my name is Dan. Dan. My question is kind of about how joy fits into the, I guess, the timeline or the structure of transcendent dependent arising. Because when I, you know, when I hear like that joy is the condition for the next stage, it sounds like something that I move on from, but obviously like I'm hoping to, I don't know, experience joy all throughout my life. It's something I want to cultivate in myself and the people around me. I guess how could you help, I guess, me understand how that, I guess, that timeline, or maybe I'm thinking about it wrong.
Good question. And I think because of it being shared sequentially, we think of it, it's so natural to like put it on it in a timeline. But I think it's both sequential, but it's circular. Mm-hmm. And it's not as if you just do the dukkha once and then you're done, yeah. You know? I think it's that inner process that happens in us in ways it's not always exactly the same. I wish I were more of a student of the suttas and the understanding that, but I think it's a process that in the end, freedom, I think, requires that we maintain an openness of the heart. And one of the co-teachers on Sunday said that the Pali word pamoja means to rest upon the heart, or to like expand from the heart, or that the heart is opening more. And I think that's an essential piece of where we're going. And I haven't thought of it as a timeline, but I can understand you doing that. See what happens if you look at it more just like the process of what happens in life, and how, what do we do with all the troubles? And how do we hold the fact that we are living in a very troubled world? And yet there's the joy that arises when you read about people who are doing such good things. You know, it's like, I don't know if you know this, but The Nation magazine nominated the city of Minneapolis for a Nobel Peace Prize. I mean, is that not a great idea? I think, anyway. Or the monks that were traveling with their dog Ahsoka, you know, and here we are, there's bombing and people dying and their homes are destroyed and there's so much fear, and it coexists with these other things. So it's a real, I think it's a big process, a big picture, as opposed to, sometimes I think of timelines as narrowing things. I don't know if that helps, but see what happens with that. I'd love to hear how you work with that.
Yeah, thank you.
Oh, you bet. Anybody else? I'm curious just also how you're doing with transcendental dependent arising. Deanna and Bo, please. Hi.
Hi.
Okay, thank you. Hi.
I feel joy is sort of a like vulnerable emotion for me. Like it's hard to let myself sort of feel it. And then when I do, I really struggle with reconciling it with impermanence, because I'm like, if I finally let myself feel it, then it might just go away. And then I'm like, or in Buddhism, right, it will go away. And so I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts on those things. Yeah.
Well, that's really interesting too. Yeah. But isn't that another opportunity? Oops, where'd you go in my picture here? You're there somewhere.
I'm here somewhere.
Oh, there you are. Sorry. Everything went around. It's also this, you know, this process again of we feel the joy, and are we going to cling to it? Oh, these three things happened, and then I have this feeling. So let me see if I can get those three things again. Or, wow, this is lovely. This, you know, and I'm feeling kind of vulnerable with it. Maybe exploring what that vulnerable is about. I think, you know, Brené Brown, the author and teacher, says that vulnerability is such a positive thing, and it's so good for our overall health and well-being. But see what happens with staying with that sense of vulnerable, and wonder if is there any concern that maybe there won't be more joy the next time?
Maybe.
Is that part of what's Can you say more about that, Bo? Or are you Deanna?
I'm Deanna. Yeah,
I'm sorry. Okay.
Yeah, I guess the fear that maybe it feels rare in some way, or maybe it's like, and I really related to what you said about sort of like, we think joy should be like this. So I'm going to reflect on that more. Maybe I'm hyping it up too much or something, but yeah, I think, I think there is some of that fear.
Yeah.
Wondering when it will come again, you know?
Uh-huh. And, you know, and what we put that label on,
yeah,
you know, what maybe we call it something else. There's a lot to explore in this, in these teachings for each of us. And we come to that understanding ourselves.
Yeah.
Yeah. I hope you come back and can share how the process is unfolding for you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I appreciate it. Appreciate your talk.
You betcha. Thank you. And there was right. Hi.
Hi there. My name's Jude. Thank you for your Dharma talk tonight. This felt very on point too. I had one of those moments where I'm like, oh, I just heard the talk I needed to hear, kind of. My partner is getting like very major surgery in a couple of days.
Could you slow down in your speaking?
Absolutely.
I want to really hear you.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you. My partner is getting very major surgery in a couple of days. Mm-hmm. And I had a conversation with her last night where she was like, your positivity is like making me pull away from you right now, 'cause I kind of can't take it in. Mm-hmm. I took that very personally, of course. And I think I have today been like, oh, I really want to approach her from this kind of like warm neutrality, but I'm struggling with like how to think of that in practice, and how do you kind of turn down positivity with someone in a difficult place?
Yeah. Anybody else ever been there? Oh my goodness. Thank you for sharing that, Jude. I think about when my partner was alive, and he was really good at asking me, if you know, what would be helpful to you right now? You know, would you like to talk about the, you know, the positive options that might, would you like to share some of your fears? Would you like maybe not to talk about your surgery and listen to music? I think our desire to make others feel better is such a good desire, but it's tricky because they're having your partner is having her own experience, and she's the one who's going to be having her surgery. I would try finding out, does she know what would be the right kind of thing? You know, there's some wonderful teaching in relationship communication where they encourage you to, if you're sharing something, to say, what I want is just listening, or just listening and you share your own experience of that thing. Or you give me some perspective that you think would be helpful, or advice. And those are very different ways of responding. And when I've been asked, what do I want? It's sometimes hard to know what you want, but you might start with, you know, really, I don't want to hear this other. Maybe you can just listen to where I'm at. And sometimes the nicest thing we can do for someone else is just allowing them to have their experience, as hard as it is. When you go on retreat with Philip Moffitt, you take a vow. You take an oath to not compare, to not judge, and to not fix. For those of us who are fixers, and it sounds like you might be one like me, those are, just to look at, what am I trying to fix? It's like Susie Sunshine was trying to fix dukkha. And sometimes what we need to do is to be with, as hard as it is. Good luck. It's a challenge. Boy, relationships. I mean, that's a whole, yeah.
Thank you.
our founding teacher used to say, if all you do is practice with your friends and loved ones, you're going to have plenty of opportunity to practice everything, you know? And one other thing, Jude, is to note, to pay attention to what's coming up in you when you're offering the Susie Sunshine approach to it. It's not bad, you know, because most of the time, a lot of times, surgeries end really well. We have this amazing healthcare system when it works, you know, and that we have competent doctors and they know what they're doing and they've done these things before. And that's all true. Yeah. And, you know, the not self doesn't say, don't take it personally when it's intended personally. And we get feedback, and Tim, one of our guiding teachers, when he was training us assistant teachers and we would give these little mini talks and we'd give each other feedback, he'd say, remember that the feedback is another person's opinion. It's their view. And if it lands with some truth, then own it. And if it doesn't, then you have to deal with that part too. But it sounds like here her feedback was truthful. Yeah. And then you go, oh, how do I respond next? Maybe an apology, a sincere apology, and then some questions about how can I really be the kind of support to you that I want to be? Yeah. Yeah. Good luck on that one. Yes, Kathy. Hi.
Hi, Suze. I liked your talk so much, and you covered all these different areas of things I've been thinking about. And I had a couple of things on my mind. One that, the poetry. I loved your poems. They really make a nice, just bring things to a point. It's about joy. I know it's around, you know, I have it, and then it clouds over, and I'm struggling a little bit with, I probably shouldn't bring this into the meeting, but I struggle a little bit with our situation in the world, and what if there is a personal role I am playing in it, what I might do about that. But then, things are just changing every second. So I'm going along with that. And my life, I had a beautiful day today. My hubby took me to Costco, and he did all the heavy lifting, every bit of it. And then I said, would you
yay, down hubby.
In the basement? And he said, yes. And he just kept doing it until it was all done. Yeah, so, you know. But I heard on the radio last night a story about a man. He's a famous author, actually. Mitch Albom is his name, I think. Mm-hmm. He, he's known for lots of wonderful things he's done. But what I didn't know was that after the Haiti earthquake, he set up an orphanage in Haiti for babies and children who were either abandoned, left outside, nobody could take care of them, all whatever. Mm. And it gets up to a population of about 50 or so of
Wow.
His children, and he has to protect them. So he's got a big wall and guard towers, and you know, it's they don't have any electronics. They go to school 10 hours a day or whatever, and they play and have their activities and games. And I just really had to reflect on that. What kind of resources and commitment that would take out of one's life to give at that level. And I felt a lot of joy when I contemplate that, and I do now too. And so it's a rich world, I guess, if we can see it.
It's not an easy life to navigate. We're all touched by what's going on in the world, and we want to respond skillfully. We can't fix everything, but we generally can do one thing, or maybe two. We can do something. And it's hard. And the reality often feels way out there. You know, it's in the Middle East. I don't know how many people here may have relatives who live in that part of the world. I had an experience Friday night. I turned on the news, and there was the picture of my brother's synagogue in West Bloomfield, Michigan, where the man had driven his vehicle into the temple and into where the preschool was, where my sister-in-law had taught for 20 years. And I thought, oh my, we think that a lot of this is out there, and there it is right here. The second part of my little story about this, which made me so happy that my heart could respond on Saturday morning, I read the article about the man who drove his car into the temple and died at the end of that. That his brother in Lebanon and two or four of his children all were killed in a bomb. And when I read that, my heart just went out to this person, not for what he had done, but the pain that he was experiencing. And it was it was immediate. It wasn't analyzing, like, he doesn't deserve my good wishes for Buddhists think that it takes 49 days and you wander in the bardo and you do what, I don't know. I don't understand what happens after we die, but we often say, you know, we wish people a good rebirth. Will he have a good rebirth with all that pain and the unskillful thing he did? Yeah, I don't know, Kathy. We all are trying to balance our inner world, our very small family, friend world, the bigger world. And each day we make the best choices we can as to how we treat each other. That's pretty important, even though it may not have any effect on the Strait of Hormuz. If we, you know, practice instant karma and aren't snarky with the clerk at the store. But, you know, being kind to the clerk at the store, it's a good thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Taking actions, whatever feels right. I don't know if I responded to your comments, but...
Well, Suze, you did. Thank you. Being kind to each other, I think that's a force I do feel from frequently, and it's so healing. And yeah. So thanks.
It's kind of like there's this worldwide bank account, and we keep throwing kindness and wholesomeness and good decisions into it. Maybe it balances some of the crap that's in there. I don't know. I don't know how to balance it all. But Mitch Albom, who's from Michigan, and it's, thank you for sharing that he did that really good thing. You know, he wrote that book, Tuesdays with Maury. It's a great book. Yeah. Yes, please.
Susie. Hi, Susie. So my name is Matthew. So between last week and today, like, we just had like two great talks. So thank you so much for sharing what you shared. Your talk made me realize something about the transcendental dependent arising. Like, so it starts with dukkha and like realizing, being aware of dukkha. And from what you shared and others have shared and my own experience, it feels like you kind of need to have like life experience, sometimes like rough life experience or not necessarily traumatic experiences, but kind of see like the suffering to realize it. And what I want to get to, and I'm asking this question because you mentioned your kids, is that when I look at my kids, I'm trying to teach some of all of this to them. Like the simple joy, being content with what we have, you know, realizing that, they have never known like hunger their whole life. And right now there are a lot of kids who have their daily life is that, and many other things. And it's very hard to teach them that. You know, they are little kids attracted by shiny things, like this joy, this definition of joy or this extreme joy that's very frivolous and shiny. That's what joy is for them. So I'm kind of wondering, like, is it sort of a requirement you have? You need to go through rough life a bit to then enter this transcendental dependent arising? Or can you enter it can you start it or enter it without having like those experiences or necessarily like having like suffered, but just trying to understand it and enter it?
Everybody asks these big questions. And, you know, as a parent, my son is older than you are. But I remember when he was little, and then I have goddaughters. I have twin goddaughters. We used to go shopping at Toys R Us or the place up on 85th and Greenwood, that fabulous toy store. Snapdoodle, I think it's called. And we used to go in there and I would say, this is a looking day. And we would look at stuff and we'd go, oh, wouldn't this just be the most fabulous stuffed dog to take home? And we just get into it. We knew we weren't buying anything. We were just looking and experiencing the desire. And that not all desires have to be met. It's so challenging to raise little ones. And you don't want to be imposing heavy, you know, it's like there are starving children over here, so eat your beets. You know, my son, would there'd be these tears coming down his face when I told him he had to eat certain vegetables. It's like, really, you know, what kind of traumas am I causing with that? It's when we started Sunday Sit, we started it for families with kids. And so that if there were two parent families, both of the parents could come and the kids could, we had an area where they could read books and play. And we started every meditation 5 minutes for them. And we talked about the mind and we had different things. And we started every Dharma talk with a children's story. And I really miss that, you know, Sunday's on Zoom now, you know, and you can't really do that. And the parents, we would all talk about, you know, how do you share some of this knowledge? I don't think you have to live for a lot of years to understand when you've hurt somebody's feelings, when you've said mean things to them, or you took their stuff away, or you wouldn't share. I don't think we have to live a long time to understand harming others and how much better it feels when you don't, or when they don't harm you. And I bow to you as a parent wanting to raise your little, I met your girls, they're adorable. And I wish you well with that. We used to have a Kalyanamita group for parents talking about, you know, raising children in this practice and how you do it skillfully. Maybe we could do that again, because that might be just to meet periodically, and also now that we have this lovely space, also come together as families and do some stuff. I used to meditate with my twin goddaughters, you know, for like a minute and a half. They liked ringing the bell, and but they'd sit and they'd get all, you know, and then one of them would start giggling, and there are those moments, you know, in parenting, there are moments when there's an opportunity for a conversation. And then there are a lot of moments that they're not. And you take those moments and you, hallelujah, you had it. You had that moment. You know, it's like when they learn, when they say, you made me cry. And there's an opportunity to learn about being responsible for your own emotions. And I remember when my son was, you know, I don't know, 7, 8, 9, and we would spend some time talking about stuff like that. And it took a long time, you know, because it takes us a long time. We still want to say, you made me mad, you know? Yeah. I don't know if that responded to.
It does. It does. Thank you.
Yeah.
And I like the idea trying bringing back this Sunday family gathering.
Yeah, it would be lovely. Well, if you want to do that, we can connect. We can figure out the other parents. You know, only 3 or 4, 5, 6 get together and do some talking about that. It's important. How's everybody doing? We only have a couple minutes. Everybody got a chance who wanted to say, oh, Carol. Carol Guile, who also happens to be Tim's mom, happens to be the best reader of children's stories. I was in a group with her for years. I loved your reading your children's stories. Hi, Carol.
I was going to say that with the North Room, and we have the library, and we have children's books, Cubba Reese, who's the board president, but also an early childhood person, we've been talking about offering maybe a once monthly circle time for kids.
Oh,
so interested,
yay.
Let us know.
Yes.
Keep posted.
Yeah. Keep your eye out for that. And just, you know, we have some really good kids' books in our library. Yeah. Thank you, Carol, for sharing that. Okay, well, we always end with something in Buddhism that it took me a long time to understand, where we dedicate the merit. And several of us go to Clear Mountain Monastery, which is another Buddhist community that meets on Saturdays. And one of the monks last Saturday gave a whole talk on dedicating merit. And the part that really spoke to me is that when we honor the goodness of our practice, the goodness that we generate by coming together, by being so real and honest and vulnerable with each other and talking about things that are important to ourselves individually and in the world, there's a goodness, there's a kind of healthy, wholesome energy that is created in this two-part sangha of people here and people in their boxes. And we want to dedicate that goodness not only to everybody who's here and to people in our own little worlds, but to beings everywhere. May all beings know the peace that can come from being safe. May all beings have the resources they need to take care of themselves. May all beings find freedom. Oop, that was loud. Sorry.